I muted myself to blow my nose. Thank you. Share that. It is April 1st, 2025. I'm not planning on any hijinks or tricks. This is just going to be normal. You can do whatever April Fool's jokes you do on your own time. I will say before we start the sit that, yesterday I've been doing some writing and I was writing about trying to learn to meditate. And it made me curious about what challenges people have just trying to kind of figure out, am I being mindful? Is this mindfulness? When they're learning to meditate. And I had a chat with one of my visitors who's Vince Collins. Some of you know him, Dharma teacher from Ireland and England. And his experience was very different from mine, and yet it included that same kind of like not knowing what the heck was going on when he was trying to learn to meditate. When I realized that when I teach meditation, I don't really address that challenge. And so I'll try to talk about it a little bit after we sit. But it made me wonder if I should change the way I teach, the way I guide meditation. But I don't know exactly how I would do that. We'll see. In any case, let us begin. Just each of us in our own space, but in this shared virtual space, settling into whatever posture is supportive of your own practice. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Really, just first of all, kind of removing the any visual distractions or the visual world. And that means then that you don't have to look at your screen, which is always a blessing. Just starting, if you can, by relaxing the body, just maybe t move the attention through the body to notice what sensations are prevalent right now. Feeling the weight of the body on your chair or cushion or couch, wherever you're sitting. Checking whether you're tense or tight in any area of the body and seeing if you can intentionally relax. And beginning to be aware of your breath. You might just feel how your body moves as you're breathing. And then noticing sensations. You might feel the breath at the nostrils, the touch of air coming in and out. Or if that's not so clear, you might feel the movement of the belly, the diaphragm, the rising and falling with the breath. If you are new to this practice, it may actually be difficult to even get enough clarity to feel the breathing. The mind can feel like a six-lane highway of chaos, thoughts and feelings, and very little clarity. Mindfulness doesn't mean concentration. Doesn't mean that you've stopped thinking. In fact, we can be mindful of thoughts. What thoughts are moving through your mind right now? But using the breath as a focal point and as a tool for calming and relaxing. Can gradually help us to settle, to feel a bit more present. This takes time, patience. But with time, it becomes quite natural, and our mind is able to pick out the breath and the feeling of being in a body. This starts to move into the foreground of our awareness. A busy mind might still be there, but not so dominant. What's important as we develop our practice is not achieving certain states. It's more important to change our viewpoint or perspective on how we understand what's happening and how we relate to what's happening. We can be unbothered by the busyness of mind or restlessness of the body. We can be accepting of that. The practice becomes more natural and pleasant. It's not necessarily that we've attained some state of peace or concentration, but rather that we see that all these mental and physical energies are just moving through us. They may be pleasant or unpleasant, but they don't have to disturb us. They're like the ripples on the surface of the ocean as we start to attune to the fact that there is actually a calmness beneath that. We might not even feel that calmness, but we can sense that it's there, know that it's there, that it's a potential. Mostly, though, to just not fight with whatever is arising, even bringing interest and curiosity to the feelings and thoughts that are coming up, while still maintaining certain connection to the breath, or at least remembering to return to that connection, to those sensations, breathing in, breathing out. The simplest of activities, the most critical and fundamental activity of our body that we participate in. Okay. All right. I was just, noticing that many of the people on here have their cameras on, and I appreciate that. And I gave a talk for the Sangha Live on the other day. What was it? Sunday, maybe. And I didn't recognize anybody's name on there, and hardly anybody turned on their camera. And so I think it maybe it's just people feel safe, like here, like you kind of know each other and know me, and I know you, and I don't know. Anyway, it's nice to see people's faces, and this is a really precious group to me. It's funny, like Monday night comes and I'm like, oh, finally it's Tuesday again. Like, it's amazing how long a week can be. Time is relative, as we know. However, it can seem like a long time between hanging out. And in this next week, on Thursday, I'm going to Little Rock, Arkansas for the weekend, but I'll be back now on Monday, and so there's a lot will happen this week, presumably. I was talking about this beforehand, and I want to kind of look at one or two things that I've been writing. Yeah, just to kind of go meta with the 1T on you a bit. I find it like as a meditation teacher, I feel this responsibility to be accurate and be of service, and I guess I have a certain amount of insecurity and self-doubt. And so as I'm writing, I've been writing something. I haven't been talking about it, but I'll just tell you what it is. It's just called Let It Go. It seems like a good title for something Buddhist. And I'm just going through a lot of Dharma teachings and viewing them through the prism of letting go and how they're related to letting go. And and I'm trying to make it, as I do, somewhat personal. And so I'm sort of talking about yesterday I was writing about my first attempts to learn to practice mindfulness of breathing. And it really kind of got, as I was saying beforehand, it really got me thinking about whether, like how to get people over that first hump, and what it even means. I think, it's an odd thing. The thing about what the Buddha does is he's very like kind of takes things apart, right, into separate things, body, feelings, perceptions, volitional formations, consciousness, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind states. But and then there's effort, there's mindfulness, there's concentration. But our experience, our subjective experience, is not divided up in that way. It's just a mush, It's just sort of like everything's happening at once, right? And so particularly, I think, when you first sit down and try to do this meditation thing, I think it's really confusing. I don't know. I mean, the first time anybody said to me, pay attention to your breath as a meditation instruction, it was at the Shambhala Meditation Center in Burlington, Vermont, in the summer of 1980. And I had been drunk the night before, so I had a need to change my meditation practice, hoping that that would repair things with my girlfriend. So, I was very, clear, wholesome motivation, but anyway, that's all the other story, right? But the meditation part, there were like two people. I don't know why they had two. And they just said, "Oh, all you have to do is just pay attention to your breath." And I was like, "What the fuck does that mean? I don't know what they're talking about." I thought, because the only way I kind of related to like being aware of my breath was from in my chest, like the idea of my chest going up and down. And that didn't seem like something to pay attention to. I don't, and it, so I was completely confused. And then I started to practice. I went back to LA in that fall and I took a class, and this monk who had just gotten back from Sri Lanka, he would put on a recording of Stephen Levine giving mindfulness instructions, and then he would leave the meditation hall and come back in 45 minutes. And mostly what happened was I was sitting as a zafu for the first time. I would just be like, I would try to be noting, right? And when it's just constantly like thinking, okay, in, out, thinking, in, thinking. And then after about 20 minutes, my knees would start to kill me. And I'd just be like, ah, this is horrible. So I didn't feel as if I was meditating or that I was even being mindful, sort of maybe-ish. And so then I went on this retreat with this teacher over Thanksgiving. It was 5 days in Joshua Tree. And again, like the sitting meditation was just this torment, and torrent. But like I started to like, I got into eating meditation. Like that was kind of interesting. And then walking meditation was like, oh, yeah, this is nice. But in some way, I still didn't feel like I was getting it. Like, so, I mean, I'm going through all this just to see if anybody relates, So finally, it wasn't until the spring when I went on a 3 week retreat that in the middle, after like 10 days of the same kind of frustration and still feeling like, oh, there's something happening and around during the retreat, but not really in meditating, not in sitting meditation, that finally something happened, and that moment still stands out in my mind, and I still question what it was exactly. But I what the way I experienced it and the way I remember it is that it was very much a physical experience, much more than a mental experience. It didn't feel like, oh, my mind is now locked in on the breath and everything is. It felt like instead the stress had fallen out of my body, that my body felt comfortable and settled. And I wasn't agitated anymore. And it was just like peaceful. And so, in a way, I wasn't bothered by what was in my mind anymore, which is, one of the jokes that I make. I think I said this on the last retreat, the difference between my meditation and the meditation of someone who's more new to practice is that we're both spacing out most of the time, but I'm not bothered by it. And people who aren't experienced are bothered by the spacing out. So, because people look at the Dharma teacher and think, oh, he's like in the jhanas, he's concentrated, he's blissful. It's like, no, I'm just like the same as you. It just doesn't bother me that's what's happening. So anyway, it all becomes, this is all part of reflecting for me, what is happening, how can I help people with this process? And then, of course, as you know, I go back to the suttas, and I was trying to find this quote that I I thought I had this quote in the in my writing, because otherwise I'm going to have to stand up and go over and get my Majjhima Nikaya. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the beginning of it, before the Buddha actually says, like, be mindful of stuff. Okay, he says that when you sit down to start to practice, you should be free from desire and discontent in regard to the world. So that's one translation of it. So it seems like he's saying that before you can even start to be mindful, you have to be free of desire and aversion or craving. And they're like, well, okay, but I thought I was meditating in order to let go of those things. How does this work? And I don't have an answer to that question. I'm just, it's another one of those things. I've read that sutta 100 times, and then, every once in a while, it's like I'm thinking about it in a different way, and I look at it and I see it differently, right? I mean, we all have these experiences with reading spiritual texts that we read something we've read many times and then go, wait, what? And then we see something else, right? So, one way for me to kind of process that is to think, yeah, that's actually what happened to me. Like, I kept sitting down and trying to meditate, and I was just still caught up in all this stuff. And then finally, things settled, and then I was able to kind of let go of the, desire and aversion or the discontent. But I don't know if that even makes any sense, So here I am processing all this in public. I probably should do this privately, but I guess part of what, I think of myself a little bit as like a meditation every man or every person. I don't feel like I have some, I'm not like this adept who is gonna this lofty being who's going to reveal all the truths to you. I feel like I'm much more like, hey, like, what's going on? Do you know what's going on? Do you understand this? And it's a strange position to be in a way, because of course I'm not that, 100% either, because I do have a lot of experience, and I know a thing or two, but I guess I'll bring it back to like one of my central questions as a teacher, which is, I mean, basically, like, am I helping people? And the that when I sit down to meditate, is my experience anything like what your experience is? Because just even though I just said it was the same thing, it's probably not, I mean, I've done a lot of practice, and I think that probably there are like neural pathways that have been established in my mind that a lot of people who are not as experienced don't have. And so when I'm like, oh yeah, just, just pay attention to your breath and, feel your body, which might feel perfectly easeful and natural to me. Maybe that's like, maybe you're in the same place I was 45 years ago, like trying to stumble through the chaos of your own mind, your own physical experience, and trying to sort out what's happening, in this way that the Buddha like sorts it out for us, and then we're trying to see it that way. So, really not, I don't know if I'm, being your friend this morning or just someone to confuse you. But I'll tell you what Vince said when I asked Vince. I said, well, what was it like when you first started to meditate. And he was like, well, it was kind of weird what I did. He went to a monastery in Thailand, but not like a Thai forest monastery. It's this monastery, Tham Krabak, where they do detoxing. And he said, you had to wear a robe and they just told you to sit down and meditate. And they didn't give any instruction and they didn't even show me how to sit. And so I was sitting wrong and it was just agony on my body for the whole month. And I was like, yeah, but did you like, what? No, it was just the whole time, it was just this frustration. And then sometime later, he went to Swan Mok, which was Buddhadasa Bhikkhu's monastery, where they teach Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. But he said that he never heard the word mindfulness. He said it wasn't like Western teachings. But again, what I'm hearing is like he's still at that place of trying to figure out what the heck you're supposed to be doing. And so people will say this to me once occasionally, like, am I being mindful? How do I know? How do I know if I'm being mindful? It will be a question people ask. And it's again one of those things that it's like we can talk about it, but it's just and I think most of the people on here have had this experience that it's like, oh, now I s it's a felt experience, it's a sensed experience. It's not mental, in the sense of being a thought. It's just oh, yeah, I kind of get it now. You kind of ease into it. But I think that as much as we can talk about mindfulness, the initial, felt experience of it, where you really sense, oh, I'm being mindful right now. That's something that takes time to find. It's not that evident. It's not as evident as I think meditation teachers portray it as. That's part of what I'm getting at, I think, here today is like this, if you have had trouble figuring out, whether you're mindful or what, then just to understand, like, that's normal. It's not as simple as it's often portrayed. But I don't think people very often talk about those initial stages of confusion and mental chaos and physical, disconnection from the body and not being able to, because for me, it's like easy to say, oh, just be aware of your body, just feel yourself sitting. And people will say, what does it mean to be aware of your body? I'm like, what do you mean? It's obvious. Like, don't you feel it? So, as the Buddha says, this is a training. And if you train at anything, the first steps are awkward, very awkward. Did you ever try to learn a musical instrument? Okay, put your fingers here. Like, what? And it's not like, oh, okay, now I'm playing the guitar. It's like, no, you're not playing. You don't feel like you're playing the guitar, playing the piano. You just feel like you're doing this sort of awkward thing with your hand, and it's like, and you're imitating, right? Which is kind of what we do in the beginning of practice. We imitate. We imitate meditation. We sit down and we do the physical. And I might look like I'm meditating, and if we're really into that, and we're flexible, we'll like get a really beautiful posture and be like, wow, that's really you're really meditating, and you're just imitating it, and. It's just, I'll say one other thing about this. I remember at one point reading some kind of a critique of meditation, and I don't know if it was a researcher or somebody supposedly quoting a researcher, but saying, well, You get as much benefit from meditating for an hour as you do from just sitting and doing nothing for an hour. I thought, what do you think we were doing? What do you think meditating was? That's just what we're doing. I don't know. So anyway, I hope this, wasn't complete gobbledygook this morning. If it makes any sense or anybody has any comments, I'd actually love to hear about people's, if anybody relates to this. When does pretending to meditate shift into meditation? That is the question we're getting at, Carson. That is the question. Right? I mean, when does pretending to play the guitar become playing the guitar? It's there's not a demarcation line. So, all right. Well, I have aroused people's interest in speaking, so that's great. Joni, you're first up.
Hi, Kevin. Thank
Hey.
you. Thank you for this. I really appreciate it. And it's funny. I would imagine most people would think, oh yeah, we don't really need to talk about this, but I think it's absolutely we need to talk about this. It's something I hear a lot in my classes. How do I know if I'm doing this right?
Yeah.
And when I remember when I started out, depending on where I went, if it was a Zen monastery, I was expected to sit on a hard marble floor in this weird, really uncomfortable position, and the monk would come around with a stick and kind of put it in my back and make me sit up straight. And he never really said anything about instruction. I was just kind of mimicking what everyone else was doing. And I thought, well, if I sit here long enough, maybe I'll understand this. And I kind of adopted the attitude of being in recovery, if you don't understand it, you just kind of fake it till you make it kind of
Yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, well, there's got to be something to this because people do it. And eventually I got so, and I was young, I wasn't 67, I was like 32, and I could bend back then, but I was so uncomfortable, I couldn't get off the floor. You know, I couldn't get up off the floor afterwards, and I thought this isn't good for my body, and I'm getting angry, so I'll go somewhere else. And I did. What I found was, I would go to a lake every weekend, and I'd go fishing with my husband at the time, and we would just stare at the lake for like days. And I thought, oh, this is meditation. I'm doing absolutely nothing. I have a pole in the water to make it look like I'm busy, but I'm not. I don't really want to catch a fish because then I have to deal with a fish. I just wanted to sit and stare at the river, at the lake, at the mountain. That was perfect for a whole weekend of doing nothing. That's when I really started to understand what meditation was. It wasn't avoidance, it was just being okay with just being. And once that light went on, though it took a couple of years, I started progressing a lot faster. It wasn't about being uncomfortable, it was about really being and being okay with being. So when I opened my meditation center, I put chairs out because if people want to sit on the floor, great. Most of us are older, we don't bend. I think comfort is a big part of learning. Rather than just sitting like, I'm really hurt right now and I want to really get up and I'm not learning anything because I hurt so bad. So I don't know. I believe in Asia, the monks probably expect you to come in with some knowledge of this beforehand because it's more cultural to them. Where here it's just really not a typical cultural thing. So anyway, thank you for this because I do get this question a lot and it helps.
That's great. Thank you, Joni. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
Yeah. I don't think I need to say anything about that. That's great. Steve.
Well, first of all, early on in your talk, you made mention of you weren't sure if this was going to be applicable, and maybe you shouldn't be talking about it. And then I started thinking, well, yeah, no, yeah, you should. All your ruminations about these experiences, I can think back when I started meditating in my 20s and then in my 30s and then my 40s, and each during those decades, thinking back on it, how I didn't have a clue what the hell I was doing. I mean, I was, and I'd go on retreats, solo retreats, and my retreats were, I don't have to go to work. So let's get drunk, let's do a lot of drugs, and let's eat to the point where I was just be sick to my stomach. You know, that's a retreat. But now I'm in my 70s, and I started to acquire this knowledge through the teachings, you know, not only just being with you in your classes, reading your books, but you know, all of the Dharma teachers, Jack Kornfield, Tara Brach, Ram Dass, all the different people that I've listened to, gives me an opportunity to really see my own personal growth and how much it has benefited me in keeping me sane. I've had some pretty horrendous meditations lately, but my experience is, so okay, I've sit for an hour, I'm in meditation, I'm feeling angry, I'm getting upset and everything, but it doesn't bother me. It really does not bother me in the slightest, because tomorrow it could be completely different. I could have wonderful feelings and be positive and blissful. So what the meditation has done for me is through the practice of just like going to 12-step meetings, you show up, you show up, you show up, you show up, and you practice and you practice, you practice. And the benefit, so I think it's vital as a Dharma teacher that you share those feelings that you have with all of us. We kind of like our students, and we show up here every Tuesday. It is a blessing to have this, and it's a blessing to hear about your own personal experiences and your struggles and where we are today. So now I loved it. It was a great talk, and I got a lot out of it. So thank you for that, Kevin.
Thanks, Steve. One of the things that Vince said yesterday is we keep going because we have, he used the word confidence, and he's using the referring to the Pali term sadha, SADHA, which usually translated as faith, but it's not a religious faith or a blind faith, but it's like we keep going because we sense, I think it's like a sense and a trust that there is some value in this. It's gonna pay off. Eventually we're gonna get it, and right now we don't get it, but it is a real thing, and a lot of times that comes from something we've read or something we've heard. So that's kind of key as well.
Thanks.
Forrest.
Great subject, Kevin.
Oh, thank you.
What I've been finding most helpful and my understanding of the Dharma as I study it, you know, is our mental constructs or thoughts or another sense, you know,
Yeah,
some
right.
operable hearing or seeing or anything. So when I'm in sitting in meditation and, you know, and observing my thoughts, I know it's hung up for a long time, because it's as soon as I was aware of my thought would vaporize. But I, you know, and sometimes now I'm more able to kind of just observe my thoughts while still anchored to my breath. And this is where some of Tara Brach's writing I found helpful. So then moving into, you know, what are my feelings around that thought, if I'm having a memory or a flashback. And then as far as my mind wandering, you know, I feel like it's a great opportunity level. And this is where my Dharma practice really dovetails way with my ACA work of being my own loving parent, because I know my mind wanders and then I get critical of myself. You know, I can even then find myself, observe myself being critical of being critical, and I can go to spiral down that hole and just absolute, you know, radical acceptance, if you will, and love. Just accepting those, you know, on its terms, and just that process over and over again, you know, day after day of sitting and going through that cycle, and just, you know, practicing that self, you know, self-acceptance. Yeah, that's where I'm kind of at, and my mind still wanders, and you know, at moments I just look at it as this great opportunity and be grateful for it.
That's great. And that's really what I'm talking about when I say I'm not bothered by it is the same thing. Like I'm not judging myself, and instead I'm recognizing like the discomfort in those thoughts, and so the and be and so self-compassion rather, right? Like that's speaking of Tara Brach and that whole kind of area that I think I appreciate you bringing this up, Forrest, because I think it's so important that we see the kind of echo what happens. Like, okay, there's busy mind, there's all this thinking going on, but then what are the other cards that are falling with that? The feelings that are showing up with that, the self-judgment that's going on with that. And sorry. And being able to be responsive to that and kind of intervening with kindness and kind of having kindness being really, I think, integrated into mindfulness. I talk about this when whenever I can, that like I don't see mindfulness as separate from loving kindness anymore. Anyway, I certainly did at one point, but rather seeing them as inherently intertwined. And for mindfulness to be beneficial, it really needs that loving kindness in the same way that loving kindness needs mindfulness. So thank you for bringing that up. Vicky, I thought maybe John had his hand up before, but okay, he's waving us off.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, here I go. Nice to be here. Great. I mean, I think this is, really helpful for me. I'm talking with people who are interested in meditation, who are new at it, who doubt themselves, and who are sober and think that this tool will help. And I sure do. It has helped me. So it seems like a very much in the line of the 12th step, what you're doing today. How can I talk to people who are getting sober about sitting down, with all the restlessness and all the craziness and there's that thing, right? If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, right? I mean, it's like I came to meditation, I came to program and meditation in pain. I was motivated. I mean, I'd heard some cool things and read some cool stuff, but really what motivated me was the pain, right? That I was in trouble. And I was like, okay, I'm willing to go to any length. I'm willing to sit here. I'm willing to go through the, I love this torment, torture, all the things you were saying was like, I mean, and getting sober too, same thing. I mean, there are a lot of people in my home group who are counting days now, and it's hang in there, baby, hang in there, right? Just hang in the, and you say it all the time, keep coming back, right? And let go, and all this overlap between Dharma and 12 step. So, I mean, it just really strikes me as important. And modeling, that old timers show up in meetings to model. It's like, and same thing. When I went to my first metta retreat, Steve Armstrong said, "Oh yeah, I just sit down and I drop in," and I'm like, "What are you talking about? What? What is that? What?"
Oh, screw you,
And
buddy.
then, no, I was curious actually.
Oh, okay, good.
I
Sorry.
mean, I was like, "Wow," because he, I don't know. He had some kind of confidence. Well, you do too. It's like your teachers are the ones. It's like, okay, I want what you have, right? I can see something going on there, and I'm willing to go to any lengths to get that thing. And so it's really interesting. But that Steve Armstrong, his the way he said it, and I've had that experience time after time with teachers. It's like certainly including where it's like, yep. This is possible, right? Well, like the Buddha. You can do it.
I agree. Thank you, Vicky. I think you are pointing to another really important thing, which is that sense of possibility. I mean, it's what I'm talking about with faith, but it also, you come into a meeting and there's some for the first time and there's somebody with 10 years and you're like, okay, I don't have that. That seems impossible, but I see that it's possible and maybe I can do it too. And that's where inevitably we're going to start with, and that's the best we're going to be able to do is to have that guiding inspiration. Before I go, I'm just gonna, I don't know if Flo is still on here, but she wrote, mindfulness of the body is somewhat difficult with a long history of not wanting to be in this body, running away from it for years. So that I think is a really important little, maybe not little, but piece of this, that mindfulness of the body, as well as other things, doesn't necessarily feel safe for everybody when they sit down to meditate, particularly if you've had trauma that hasn't been resolved in any way, that and so that there is this alienation from the body. And I will say for myself, I didn't have that, but I was alienated from my emotions. And it wasn't safe to feel my emotions. So when my teachers started to say, you need to pay attention to your feeling, that was like alien to me. I didn't understand. I didn't know how to do it because I had avoided my feelings. So I didn't have that skill. And that was a big part of learning to be mindful, because you can be mindful of your body and your mind, and your thoughts, but you can be missing these whole areas of experience, right? We don't know what we're missing because we don't know what we don't know. We need Donald Rumsfeld here to, complete the quote. But we don't know what we don't know. And so then, if we stumble on the idea that, oh, there's something I should be doing, or it's really presented to us, oh, be mindful of your body, be mindful of your feelings, then that can create a whole other, challenge, something that we have to get over. I'm seeing a fence or something we have to jump over, a wall that takes time. And yeah, this process, it is a training, and it really takes time to find our way through this and to really make this into something that's authentic for us, that's real for us. And we start by faking it. Fake it till you make it. And if you hang in, those of us who have been around for a while, we assure you that it will be a benefit. It will start to click for you. Hopefully something we say along the way will help that click, because that's often part of how this works, that we hear something that suddenly connects with what we've been experiencing, and we put it together, and that's called insight. So thank you all for showing up for yourselves and for each other, and I don't know, for me too. I appreciate it. I notice how many people, participants there are. We hit 50 this morning. I was like, 50? Wow, I'm a star. No, it feels good to have people, here and be together and keep doing this stuff as long as we can. And
it's good for our recovery.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. So I'll be taking all our positive energy to Little Rock, which I was looking into yesterday. Quite interesting. I can go to the Bill Clinton Library if I want to. And they also actually have a museum at Central High School there, which, again, those of us of a certain age recall that the President Eisenhower sent in the, I think it was the 101st Airborne or something crazy like that, or National Guard anyway, to escort the first black student to high school in Little Rock in like 1957 or whenever it was. And it's kind of beautiful. That's still an active high school, but they have a museum across the street about it. And it reminded me of what I saw at Alcatraz. It's like, this is beautiful to see this history. Why do people not want to see the struggles for civil rights that we've had in this country that have been, you know, done by courageous people and have tried to move us forward? I'm grateful for all that. So anyway, I hope you all have a safe week. Enjoy April. It's next week. So yeah,
to be home in time to get ready.
I will be home in time to watch the Masters. Yes, I seem to have by accident kept that weekend open. So, all right, everybody.
Yeah. Namaste.
Have a great day. Happy April Fools. Don't get fooled again.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin. Really appreciate it.
Ba-dum-bum.
Ba-dum-bum.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you. Oh, good.